Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's an oldie, it's a goodie. It's right now, it's Florio. Oh man, been a long time since I heard that one. Longer time since I sung that one. Long time since we welcomed in Mike Florio right here on The Score on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford is in Melrose Park. I mean, you guys hear Florio every Wednesday at 10, usually right here with Dan Bernstein. Today with me, Matt Spiegel, as we say good morning in the middle of August to Mike Florio. What's up, man? How are you?
Boy, that takes me back. That takes me back. You know, I don't know what I prefer more, hearing that or hearing Dan's setup where Aaron Rodgers says, among other things, don't listen to crap written by people like me.
Well, maybe we can put them together in some kind of super
cut. Can we get Aaron Rodgers to sing the song? I don't know how much scotch and or tequila it would take, but there has to be a magic number that would get Aaron Rodgers to the point where he would do it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's not feeling very secure about things in Green Bay. Maybe he's ready for the next career. You know, it's like you got to be thinking about what you're going to do. I long, Mike Florio, for the days where we could be angry and have, you know, sports outrage, justifiable or not, about silly little things like the Packers having the audacity to draft a quarterback without telling Aaron Rodgers it was coming. That was fun when we could be upset about those things. There's much more serious things to discuss these days.
I would love to go back to the days where the debate is, in what week is Mitchell Trubisky going to be benched? I mean, you know, those things, those annoyances, those topics, those subjects, hopefully one day we'll be back to those being the most important things we're discussing at any given time.
So Anthony Lynn is, by my count, the third or is it the fourth head coach to now have come forward and say that he had COVID-19 at one point here?
Yeah, third that we know of. The question is, how many others are there that have had it? And that was a point that was raised with me by a general manager earlier this week when Peter King pointed out that six teams have had no positives of any kind, players, coaches, staff. The reality is that they are giving antibody tests and they aren't announcing the results of the antibody tests. Now, the players can come out and say it if they want to, but there's a belief that plenty of the people who are testing negative for the virus are testing negative because they've already had it. And we don't know how long the antibodies last, but, you know, a guy like Anthony Lynn, if he's had it fairly recently, he's not going to test positive. He's not going to catch it again. And again, we don't know how long you're immune from getting it again. They still don't know much about this. It's amazing after 6 months how little they know about it. But that was the thing that really underscored for me the possibility that a lot of these negatives are the result of the fact that people have already had it. And if they can get it again, what if they get it again in November or December and then all of a sudden your starting quarterback's gone for a week or two? I mean, obviously the bigger issue is let's not get anybody sick. But the way this thing's operating, even if you're asymptomatic, you're not getting anywhere near the field.
So Anthony Lynn, it's revealed last night on Hard Knocks, in the debut, I believe, of Hard Knocks, the 15th edition, and it starts with a Zoom call, and it's Anthony Lynn telling the players what's what, and Joey Bosa has the look of surprise as I read off Mike Florio's site here at ProFootballTalk.com. I guess my general question is this, Mike, and we can talk about, of course, whether they're going to play or not, but is the feeling as cavalier from NFL management as I once thought it was. When Bruce Arians kind of unwittingly said, well, yeah, of course the players are going to get sick. It's a matter of how sick they're going to get. You know, that was just like a little window into how it seemed a lot of coaches and I think a lot of owners might feel about it. Do they feel that cavalier as a group about the players and about what they'd be willing to endure to try and get their sport in?
It's funny, you think back to March 11, it was one positive test for Utah Jazz forward Rudy Gobert that shut down basketball, hockey, baseball, everything in its tracks. And now we're at a point where we just accept it, we just tolerate it. I had a coach tell me last week, look, we got to run the numbers here. We got to look at this. Full scope of NFL employment, teams, the number of people who have their fingerprints on an organization any given day, a couple of hundred per city, per team, times 32, chances are, over the course of 6 months, somebody's going to get sick, and there's a chance one or more people may die. What is the NFL going to do if that happens? And the concern was raised to me along the lines of, there was a sense among the teams that the NFL is trying to posture itself so it can say, not our fault, teams didn't handle it well enough, don't blame us, we put the protocols in place. If there was a failure, it's the team's fault. And look, that's, you know, an afterthought if you have that kind of an outcome, but you always have that element of, we want to protect ourselves, we want to cover our butts here. And I think there is a sense that it's inevitable somebody eventually is going to be not asymptomatic. We hear over and over and again, so-and-so is positive, asymptomatic, asymptomatic, asymptomatic. Well, that's not going to last forever because of the raw numbers, because of the potential for the virus to get into these facilities. And I don't know how the NFL is going to react. I don't know how the teams are going to react if that happens, but that's something we have to be paying attention to, because even though so far so good, and people I talk to behind the scenes, very confident they're going to get all the games in, if there are guys who can't play, you replace them with someone else and you just keep going, just like injuries, right? The same mindset, yeah. Next man up, and they're confident they're going to be able to do it, but at some point it's going to yield to the real world reality that there's going to be a player, a coach, a staff member who gets sick and possibly dies, and how does the NFL deal with that? What's the right thing to do if that happens? And I'm hoping the NFL has a plan for that. If it comes to it, I hope it doesn't come to it. But a lot of times we see that it's just kind of make it up as you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's for sure. There's so many lessons from baseball, whether it's to simply not be the Miami Marlins, or whether it is, you know, I feel like there's a benefit for the baseball owners having not put down specific parameters in terms of what would shut down the season. So then they can withstand what the Marlins have gone through and the number of players they've lost. They can withstand the fact that the Cardinals have played 5 games while other teams have played 15 or 17 games at this point. There is nothing specific about what would trigger a shutdown. Do you think if they have a plan and move forward in the NFL, will they leave the same ambiguities so it gives them room to adjust and say, well, we knew this was coming? Will there be nothing specific in writing that would trigger a shutdown for the NFL?
They have plans in place on how to deal with outbreaks, but I don't think they have anything that is written out that would articulate what needs to be done from the standpoint of postponing, canceling, suspending a given game. And there was talk a couple of weeks ago about the commissioner potentially having the power to determine, based upon whatever factors will be relevant. And I think it's going to be critical to have a clear formula, not a sliding scale, not a make it up as you go, not a, well, it's a 1 o'clock game on a Sunday Eastern time, so we can scrap that one because there's 8 others. But you know what? The primetime game Monday night on ESPN, we better just go ahead and play that, even if one of the teams has no healthy offensive linemen. But that's the context that it's come up. Position group wiped out by COVID-19. Would you give a team a pass? Would you postpone a game to a week 18 or 19, where basically it would be makeup week for the games that get postponed? Would you tolerate going into a postseason with some teams having played 16 games, others having played 15, some playing 14, and you go on win percentage to see who gets the playoff spots? Those are all things that I think are available to the NFL, depending upon what happens. Dr. Alan Sills, who has been very available to the media for the most part, I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and he said all options are on the table. And I think they mean that. They are determined to go forward and try to get all 256 games in, but they're going to do whatever they have to do to adjust on the fly as the virus dictates what can and can't be done.
Yeah, you know, there's intellectual sense in leaving things ambiguous because you have to adjust and adapt as you move forward. But it also makes fiscal sense to leave things ambiguous because you set something in stone and you might very well steamroll past it. Like baseball, there's not a limited number of game threshold. You know, some teams are playing 60, some teams might play 50, 45. What's too few? 40? You know, like if the NFL says, well, you have to play at least 12 games, if all of a sudden nobody's playing more than 12 games, they would have to adjust. So I don't think they're going to put anything in writing in that sense. Mike, what is the number of people in a traveling party, vaguely, for an NFL team? I mean, you've got the roster of what? The roster of 53.
Practice squad of 16, so there's almost 70 right there, right?
Yep.
Coaching staff, another 15. Uh-huh. That gets you up around 85, 90. Then you've got all the other essential personnel. I mean, I've heard numbers 150 to 170. You know, they're going to try to trim it down as much as they can. But, yeah, that's the next frontier. 4 weeks from tomorrow when the Texans pack it up and go to Kansas City, right? Can they do it in a way that limits any invasion of the traveling party by the virus, and that's going to play out every week. I mean, I think that it's one thing to say we've gotten under control in the 32 facilities, whether they have a bubble approach or not, because some of these teams have a hotel where players are staying. But once you start packing it up and taking it on the road, that's when you may end up having issues, and you just have to wait and see what happens after a given game. Are people going to start testing positive, and how far is this thing going to spread before we can get it under control?
Mike Florio from ProFootballTalk.com is with us. So Alvin Kamara of the New Orleans Saints, as I shift gears wildly, has just said that he's plant-based. So if he's vegan, if Kamara is vegan, Cam Newton is vegan too, right? I don't know what the total numbers are in the NFL, but I don't know about you, Mike, but I'm doing it myself these days. It's like, And we'll see how long I can get it going, but I'm feeling pretty good. And I just watched that Game Changers documentary a couple weeks ago where, I forget who it was, the linebacker from the Tennessee Titans a few years ago had gone plant-based, and his wife all of a sudden got just about everybody on that defense into a plant-based diet. This is what the gladiators apparently were eating in Roman times. And how big a craze is this around the NFL right now, Mike?
Well, I mean, it is a fairly big craze. I thought you were going along the lines of the Colin Kaepernick ongoing unemployment, because one of the things that kept him out of the league is the idea that he's a vegan. Remember that, when they were throwing anything they could at those who were suggesting he should get an opportunity? Well, he's a vegan. We're concerned about his diet. Yeah, there's plenty of guys who go plant-based. And, you know, as long as you get your protein, as long as you get your nutrients, it really doesn't matter how you go about doing it. And, you know, these are guys who are careful about every single thing they put into their body. Tom Brady with the avocado ice cream that we've heard about over and over again, and his very careful approach. And it's not just getting maximum performance now, but it's a lifestyle that, you know, I think some of these guys think they're going to live to be 150. Although, you know, there really is a point where it's like, yeah, you know, I'd like to make it to 100, but, you know, I don't know about the quality of those last 10 years. On that happy note.
See, no,
I don't know that eating plants is going to make 90 to 100 all of a sudden like 60 to 70. I don't know that. If that's true, then I'm going to go out and start gnawing on whatever weeds I can find in my yard right now.
But don't you think that scale slides? Like, as you hit your 70s, you're like, boy, I'd like it to feel like I did in my 50s. I really would. So as long as the 90s feel like your 70s, I think you're okay.
Oh, hey, I know that a friend of mine, his mother's position is that she just wants to make it to 80 and she's done. She doesn't want to be 80, 81, 82. She just, you know, 80 and out. It's like, yeah, that sounds good until you're 79 and 364 days. Then you may have a different viewpoint on that.
Oh, God. Oh, Mike Florio, a couple more minutes real quick with Mike Florio on ProFootballTalk.com. Actually, maybe just one more. So Washington football team, do we have to capitalize all three of those words? And is that what they're going to play as if we have a season?
WFT, Washington football team, that is the name for now. And I'll tell you what, I've got two predictions. If they end up making it to the playoffs this year and crazier things have happened and there's an extra berth per conference this year. So, you know, teams are going to be alive a lot longer than they otherwise would be, scrambling for that seventh spot. If they make it to the playoffs, I think they keep the name for another year or two. And if somehow, some way, they pull the ultimate inside straight and get to the Super Bowl. And I'll say this, 1982, crazy upside-down season, 9 regular season games, Washington made it to the Super Bowl and won it. 1987, crazy upside-down season, 15 regular season games, 3 of which were played by replacement players, Washington went to the Super Bowl and won it. If they would somehow have a special season, I don't think they ever changed that name. The uniforms are awesome. The big gold numbers on the side of the helmet, that's a great look. The burgundy and gold has always been a great color combination. I could see Washington football team, kind of that soccer influence where you don't have a nickname for the team. It's just the name of the team. If they are good, I think that name is going to last for a while and maybe for a long while.
That they're just going to lean into Washington football team.
And it's a copycat league, too. Maybe before you know it, it's going to be the Chicago football team, although I doubt that. I doubt that. Of all the teams out there that potentially would convert to just, you know, insert city name and team, the last one to go would be the Chicago Bears, because you can't have football without Chicago Bears.
Right, and I think we as a species, humanity, we're okay with our treatment of Bears. You know, we're all right with that. We don't feel like we've done wrong by the Bears.
Well, and you know, I still get the tweets and the emails, Matt, from the people who don't want to just accept the fact that the name has changed, saying, well, Vikings needs to go now, too. Cowboys needs to go. They did horrible things. Saints is offensive to non-Catholics, and Giants is offensive to large people. It's like, look, only one name was a dictionary-defined slur. You want to have an argument or discussion about Chiefs and the tomahawk chop, that's a different issue. But this was the easy one. This was the no-brainer. This was the fruit that wasn't just hanging low. It was on the ground and decomposing. It was a slur that needed to go. The rest of it, it's just kind of goofy talk, but that's where the people who didn't want the name to change are now residing, because they're mad they lost their name. They want other teams to lose their names, too.
Yeah, you know, Giants, I'd love to be a Giant, you know, so screw those people. Those are wrong.
George Morrison said it's not all it's cracked up to be. Remember him?
I do. I remember it well. Mike, thanks, man. Nice to talk to you. All right, you got it. That's Mike Florio from ProFootballTalk.com. You know, as the Cubs are playing the Cleveland Indians, and the White Sox just played the Cleveland Indians, you're reminded that that's the other one. And right now their logo is a C. It's a giant C. I don't think they'll be the Indians in a couple of years. I think they'll be the Cleveland Spiders. And that would be pretty cool. Let's talk NHL. Blackhawks and the Las Vegas Golden Knights. Are the Golden Knights what the Blackhawks used to be? And how is the bubble working? By the way, there was a 5 overtime game yesterday as well. From NHL.com, it's Kevin Weeks. That is coming up next, midday, midway at 10:40 or so. And then Len Casper, top of the hour. It's Matt Spiegel in for Bernstein right here on 670 The Score. This segment is brought to you by Burlington Stores. Have you been to a Burlington lately? They have unbelievable deals on amazing brands and styles at up to 60% off other retailers' prices. No coupons or sales, just fabulous values every single day. Whether it's back to school, work, or just back, you'll love Burlington.
Chicago Cub Ian Happ talks Cubs baseball with Dan Bernstein every Thursday.
There's a picture of Chris and Zach on the field, and the Instagram account actually tagged the picture with both of them and said, big bro, little bro. And Zach looks like he's 4'4", and Chris looks like he's 7'8". Like, it's hilarious. A really good picture.
Ian Happ with Dan Bernstein, Thursdays on Sports Radio 670 The Score, official radio home of the Cubs, and a radio.com sports station. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Gajula hacked it toward the middle, nobody home for Chicago. And back come the Knights. Marchessault deflected to Smith right in, he scored! What a shot! Riley Smith settled down a rolling puck and roofed a backhander. 4-1 now. If there are a couple of inches different, story might be different, but the story tonight is the Las Vegas Golden Knights capture game one of this best of seven series. Hawks limited to 4 shots in the third period. They finished with 20. The Golden Knights had a dozen, and their final total is 33. So Las Vegas remains perfect in postseason play. Game two, a 5:30 start on Thursday night. Look forward to seeing you then, partner.
We expect a tight series. We expect it to be a grind. We expect to face adversity. We did that. and we were right there. But we're going to have to find a way to win some of these games, but we got to put ourselves in that position as well. And again, we just got to stick with it. And they did it a little bit longer than us. And that's the message.
Those highlights are courtesy NBC Sports Chicago. And that's Jeremy Colliton after the game as the Hawks dropped the first of this series, this seven-game series against the Las Vegas Golden Knights by a score of 4-1. It's Matt Spiegel in for Dan Bernstein right here on 670 The Score. And pleased now to welcome to the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park, is Kevin Weeks. Kevin Weeks, the NHL Network analyst. You see him on NHL Tonight, their wall-to-wall coverage on NHL Network all throughout the 2020 Stanley Cup playoffs. You can follow him on Twitter at Kevin Weeks with an E between the K and the S. Kevin, good morning and welcome on to The Score in Chicago. How you doing?
Good morning, Chicago. Everything is great. No complaints. Yeah, everybody's healthy here in Jersey at home in New York City. And our family back in Toronto and in Calgary are doing well, too. So hope the same for all the listeners that are tuned in and all the great Hawks fans. Hope everybody's doing well in Chicago right now.
Hey, Kevin, thank you. Yeah, that's the main priority, that's for sure. And we are pleased to have three active teams. You know, who needs the Bulls when you've got the Cubs and the White Sox playing very well? And then the Blackhawks. What a joy it was to watch them get past Edmonton and get this opportunity for the young team. It seems, though, right now they're up against a team that frankly reminds a lot of us of what the Hawks looked like during some of their cup runs. Supremely skilled on the top line are the Las Vegas Golden Knights, but boy, they are deep and they are fast with two goaltender options they feel pretty good about. They just seem pretty much state-of-the-art right now, at least in the Western Conference. How good are the Knights, and do they remind you at all of the Cups, the Blackhawks a few years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Knights. I got to be honest. Ever since they came into the league, I had a chance to speak to their owner, Bill Foley, their majority owner, during the expansion draft. We were live on the air with the NHL Network for the expansion draft, and everything he told me and their former coach, Gerard Gallant, told me about how they were going to play, what they were going to look like, the way they were going to operate as a franchise, all of those things have been in place. And, you know, obviously that coincided with them going to the Stanley Cup Final in their inaugural season, and they haven't looked back. Stylistically, in a lot of ways, they do remind me of the Hawks when the Hawks were going and when the Hawks were at their height winning those three Stanley Cups. And I say that because their ability to skate and make plays and move the puck. I think that this Vegas Golden Knights team is deeper than their inaugural year team that went to the Stanley Cup Final. I think they're deeper. But to kind of pivot that, I still think that this has the chance to be a closer series than people recognize. As I said, I thought the Hawks would beat Edmonton. I said that on our air, and they did that. And I feel like the Hawks, quite frankly, you know, with their rebuild, they're the youngest team in the league. And yet still, they've punched their ticket to the Stanley Cup playoffs. And when you have the superstars, superheroes, as I call them, and the great Patrick Kane, the great Jonathan Tate, Duncan Keith still playing at a high level, Corey Crawford in the net. Anytime you have those guys, you still have a chance. And, you know, Kubalik has been so great this year, scoring 30. He had that game in the qualifying series of 5 points, a record. So all things being equal, I think the Hawks can still make this a very close series.
Well, I would love to see that, Kevin. I'm not sure what the formula is, though. I mean, maybe it's are the Hawks better off facing Marc-Andre Fleury at this stage in his career than they are facing Robin Leonard, who obviously they know very well and just sent to Vegas in February? Like, do you want should Hawks fans dream of Leonard having a bad game or two and the Knights going to Fleury? Do the Hawks have a better shot if that's the case?
I'm not necessarily sure. I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury is a future Hall of Fame lock. He still has game. I'd say that they chose Robin Leonard because Leonard played better down the stretch, so they started with him in the playoffs. You know, ironically, too, for you Hawks fans, Leonard, I think, was really good in Chicago, too, this year. But yep. let's keep that in mind. At the start of the year, the Hawks were giving up 40 shots a game like candy, and Robin Leonard was money for you guys there. And it really allowed Corey Crawford the time to get healthy and to not only get healthy but get back on the ice and in the net and rediscover his form. So I thought that was a smart signing originally by Stan, and, you know, obviously you traded him thinking that you guys were out of it, and then you guys made a push based on your team. So would you be better off facing Marc-Andre Fleury? I don't know. I can't necessarily pinpoint that per se, but here's what I do know for the Hawks. I feel like they left a lot of shots on the table last night. They only got 20 shots. And I felt like offensively, as that series went on against Edmonton, the Hawks were more assertive offensively. And what do I mean by that? They were shooting from angles. They had more traffic in front of Koskinen and or Mike Smith. They were getting to the net more. They didn't leave any shots on the table. I felt last night in game one, that'll be an adjustment that they can make for game two, is to take more shots and in shooting more pucks, get more traffic to the net and create a little bit more chaos in front of Robin Leonard, because he is a big goalie as well. And I thought they did a good job doing that in the first series against Edmonton. They'll need to revisit that and get that back in their game here in game two.
So Robin Leonard is 5-0 for the Knights. They love how he came into summer camp after the shutdown, ready to go, intense, on fire. His biggest battle last night was with a skate blade. Your former goalie, yeah, exactly. Kevin Weeks. I mean, my God, have you ever lost a skate blade like Robin Leonard did twice in the same night?
I was going to say, it's crazy, but Robin Leonard wears those, as do a lot of players, he wears those quick-release blades where the trainers don't have to take the skate into the locker room and basically perform surgery to get to swap your blades. You literally hit a button at the back, and in hitting that button, you can swap out a blade instantaneously. So that's both a blessing and a curse for him last night. That was a curse. But I'll tell you one thing that's dangerous about that for, you know, the fellow goalie aficionados and your listeners that are tuned in, is what makes that dangerous is you lose that blade, you don't have contact with that skate, and that skate now, the blade's out. So basically, you're now on plastic. It's not the best idea to be on plastic on a hockey rink as opposed to being on the steel of the blade to dig into the ice. So fortunately for him, he wasn't injured, but that could have very well been an instance where he goes to push and, you know, heaven forbid, he tweaks a knee or a groin or a hamstring. So fortunately, he was able to come out of it unscathed.
Tell us about what you saw from Corey Crawford last night. It's been a really interesting ride, frankly, for Hawks fans who early on had to convince that Crawford was the man, and then he proved it, and then he got paid a lot, and then people have wondered whether he should be paid as much, but then he kind of keeps proving it when he's given a chance. And then the concussion problems and the lengthy delay, like, we watch him very carefully to see if he is fully on point in terms of all of his instincts and his wherewithal, his mindfulness. It's such a challenge for a goalie to be on point and in the moment, just so solid all the time. What are you seeing right now from Corey Crawford in terms of his level of concentration and attentiveness?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've always been a big Corey Crawford backer. You think of what he's been able to accomplish. He was down in the minors in Norfolk for a long time, overripe, if you will. And, you know, as somebody that played in the minors myself and as a young goalie, I think that's critical to your development. And I played in the AHL and the old IHL. So I respect the path that he's taken to get to where he got to. And it wasn't handed to him. And he's had to prove a lot of people wrong internally and externally. And I credit him for that. And, you know, it's a guy that's won 2 Stanley Cups. The guys love playing in front of him. You know, anybody I talked to in that locker room over the years or currently has nothing but great things to say about, you know, playing in front of Crow, as they call him there. So, you know, even the fact now, guys, keep in mind, he just overcame COVID. Like, yeah, it's wild that he's even playing. He only had 1 practice before joining the team up in the bubble in Edmonton. Like, imagine being off that long and having a 4.5-month pause and then coming back and having COVID amidst the global COVID pandemic, and then coming back and playing an NHL Stanley Cup playoff action. It's wild. Like, there's very few guys that I played with or that I played against as goalies that would be able to do that, honestly. Like, that's almost impossible. So the fact that he's done that is a testament to him. You know, he has had some of the injury troubles in the last several years with the concussions and things of that nature, so I understand the concern there. But anytime he's in the net, the Hawks have a chance to win. And, you know, he's been nothing but a great Blackhawk, to be honest. Like, he's won more playoff games than any Hawks goalie in Hawks history. And the Hawks certainly have a very rich history as one of the prestigious original six franchises. So I thought yesterday there are two of them that he should have had, specifically the one that went off his blocker and kind of ramped up. Mm-hmm. But all things being equal, you know, I look for him to be better. And quite frankly, I look for the whole team to be better because I don't feel like the team played well yesterday either. You know, I thought Brandon Saad had a tremendous game. You can make a case that he was the best Hawk on the ice. But aside from that, they didn't look like themselves overall in that game yesterday. They left left a lot to be desired in that one. They certainly have more. And I'm sure Jeremy Colton and the staff and Taser and Kaner and those guys would say the same thing.
Yeah, it was fun to watch Saad last night. I mean, we've kind of always dreamed of Saad taking that Marian Hossa role alongside Taves there on the top line, just being big and strong and being a two-way guy. And he was, I mean, especially that play on the shorthand, the shorty was quite something. One more for you, for Kevin Weeks right here on 670 The Score. So maybe it ages me, but I see five overtimes. I think of Pat LaFontaine, but hell, that was only four overtimes in 1987.
Yeah.
How five overtimes? What does that do psychologically if you're Columbus and you play that far and that long and lose it? What does that do to you in a series?
I love that you're hyped about it because I'm hyped about it too. You know what that does? That says, boys, we're Warriors. We're Warriors. Seth Jones played 65 plus minutes in that game. The most minutes played by any skater in an NHL game in history.
Wow.
Zach Werenski played 63 minutes in that game. His defense partner. I mean, your goalie in Corpusalo made 85 saves. 85. The NHL record is 92 saves in a game in the 1930s. I mean, so, and by the way, when I talk about shot attempts and I talked about the Hawks earlier, Tampa had 188 shot attempts in that game. It's like you could play NHL 2020 or whatever on Xbox or PS5, and you can't get that many shot attempts. Like, it's wild. I've never seen that. You could play bubble hockey, super checks, and not get that many. To do that, you can't even do that in street hockey. Like, honestly, I've never seen that before. So, you know what? That's
wow.
It's a testament to those two teams. It's as Coop said, Coach Cooper of Tampa, it's a shame somebody had to lose. And I said this on the NHL Network last night. The Tampa Bay Lightning won the game. Nobody lost the game. Like, that's one of the best games in the history of pro sports right there.
Wow. See, that's a great way to try and spin it psychologically. Hey, boys, we will fight. We will do anything we have to do. I know we lost, but 100%. Seth Jones played 65 minutes, and he's ready to go. We can do anything.
Totally. Did you see when they panned the bench after the game? Seth Jones is just like, yeah, I'm good. Like, he didn't even look fazed. And I talked to guys from both teams. I can't say who, but I talked to guys from both teams. They're like, Weeksy, that was freaking wild. Like, I was texting guys post-game from the set when guys were in the locker room. So, you know what? That's what makes the Stanley Cup playoffs unlike anything else in professional sports. I've got a lot of friends in every sport and every league. I say this all the time. And you mentioned the Bulls earlier. Congrats to my man, Mark Eversley, from back home in Toronto, whose parents are also from Barbados. He is the new GM of the Chicago Bulls.
Wow.
But congrats to him. Yep, congrats to him. So I've got friends in every league. But, hey, there's nothing. I'm watching a commercial right now on our NHL Network. There is nothing, and I say nothing, like the Stanley Cup playoffs in the NHL. Nothing.
Wow. So you never know when you're going to get Bulls information in this town. I got it from Kevin Weeks right here.
There you have it, man. Yep. I got Mark Eversley. Make sure you treat him nicely. He's brilliant.
All right. Well, good. We're hoping that he and Arturis Karnišovas have full control of the organization. A fan can dream in this
Absolutely.
Town. And Kevin, thank you so much, man. This was really fun. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. Thanks so much for having me on. And also big thanks to all those Hawks fans that watch us on the NHL Network. We know there are a lot of you, so thanks so much for tuning in to watch us.
You got it. That's Kevin Weeks, at Kevin Weeks with an E between the K and the S on Twitter, and you can catch him over on NHL.com. And see, you never know. You never know. It reminds me, years ago, I remember listening to a White Sox game when Ed Farmer, rest in peace, Ed Farmer, what a wonderful guy. Ed Farmer was doing the game, and it was the middle of a Luis Valbuena at bat in an Indians-White Sox game. And Ed Farmer, I always wish we could find this tape. I know Chris Tannehill has looked for it. But he said, hey, folks, I'll tell you what. You've heard some news, heard some rumblings that Phil Jackson might be coming back to the Bulls. That's not happening. And you can book it. Here's the 2-1 pitch to Valbuena. Like, you never know when you're going to get Bulls news in this town. It might be during a Luis Valbuena at bat, or it could be during a hit with Kevin Weeks from the NHL Network. It's Matt Spiegel in for Dan Bernstein right here on 670 The Score. When we come back, some of the coolest audio that I've heard in a ball game in a while. A nice long conversation between Len and JD and Ryan Dempster that Jay Zawoski has compressed down nicely for you that you need to hear, because it's some really cool baseball porn stuff, in my opinion. You'll hear that next in advance of Len Casper at 11 o'clock right here on 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Baseball.
Welcome back in on 670 The Score. Some things work in a broadcast and some things do not. Ryan Dempster has a really nice rapport with Len Casper and Jim Deshays. And even with Demp back at Wrigley last night while Len and JD were in the next booth and the Cubs are there in Cleveland, it was nice chemistry, nice vibe, and an easy listen as John Lester pitched very well. Colin Ray pitched well. We need to talk about him with Len in a few minutes, and we will. And Jason Hayward had a big offensive night, among others. But a really cool moment. If you missed it, listen up. If you know a hardcore baseball fan, tell a friend, or a hardcore Cub fan, tell a friend. The question arose about tipping pitches, about whether you could tell from what a guy is doing. And I think it was while they were watching Logan Allen pitch for the Indians. And he kind of did a weird thing with his glove where he moved his arms back before he threw the pitch. So thus begat a conversation about tipping pitches and maybe even tipping pickoff attempts. Good stuff here with Len, JD, and Ryan Dempster last night on Watch Marquee. Give it a listen.
Hey, Demp, we got a tweet. Steve on Twitter asked me to ask you, but I see Tapera starts with a split finger grip. How do you hide not changing the grip after it goes into the glove? And you talked about your glove waggle, and that's one thing, right? So if you were changing your grip, you just wanted to fiddle with your hands all the time the same way, correct?
Yeah, you find something that works. And I'm, you know, speaking of that, I'm just watching Logan Allen here as he takes the sign and then he does this movement where he puts his hands up and down. I don't know if that's changing the grip there or what it is, but for me it was the most comfortable thing. It was noticeable when I went from a split to a slider or fastball, the movement in my wrist. And you know, because for me I didn't have big enough hands to be able to, you know, just reach in and grab a split, so I always had to preload the split. And then when I put it in my grip, if you're looking, as I would get out, you would see my wrist move. So I'd go to a fastball or a slider, and so that's why I started wiggling my glove just kind of casually, and then it just started speeding up so fast I think I have mild carpal tunnel from it. But
did you self-diagnose that would be a problem, or did anyone see it and tell you should do it?
I did. Well, when my hitting took a dive, I knew that there was probably some wrist issues, but I sacrificed it for my ability to pitch better.
Gotcha. Yeah, did you have a teammate, JD, who was good at picking up that stuff? I know Mike Mordecai was great. He could watch a guy throw three pitches and go, okay, this is what he does on his...
Yeah, I don't remember anybody specifically. I like to feel like I was tipping the pitches at the end of my career. Helps me sleep better at night. Between the steroids and tipping pitches.
Is that consolation, tipping?
Yeah. Well, you know what happened, too? And I was always the guy that brought the glove over my head. So if you have a changeup grip and your, you know, hands in the glove and you bring it up, you're going to show a lot of white. I think that's what the hitters would pick up. But if you got the ball choked back, say, in a fastball, and when you bring your hands up over your head, they're not seeing all that white. Hitters are diabolical that way.
I always didn't appreciate the guy that was on the bench. Like you were saying, the Mike Mordecai. So I'm like, man, you're so good at that. Like John Mabry could see it in a heartbeat, left-handed hitter who played here in Chicago, and he could find out within about four or five pitches, same sort of way. Jim Edmonds. I remember playing in Milwaukee. Jim Edmonds said the pitcher was breathing too heavy on his changeup.
What?
He called it, and he said, I'm going to catch him breathing too hard, and I'm going to hit that changeup opposite field for a home run, and sure enough, he did.
Wow.
Yes.
Took a deep breath before the changeup, huh?
Yep. Young kid was just taking a, you know, a pitching coach probably told him, all right, make sure you take a deep breath. Don't be in a hurry. Right. And he took that literal. And it was every time on his changeup, you could see it from the side, clear as day.
And I played with guys, and I guarantee you, if they knew you were tipping your pitches and they were a teammate, they wouldn't tell you because they may face you someday in the future.
Yeah,
that's a hard business, right, man.
You got that right. Derek Lee, my teammate for 12 years, about 7 years into our teammate relationship. I'm coming off the field one day, and he goes, hey, Demp, you know every time I know when you're picking over to first base. I said, well, you've been my teammate for 7 years, and you've never told me this? He goes, well, I wanted to make sure I was going to still be playing with you.
There's a statute of limitations. Yeah.
So what was the tell?
When I would go to first base, I'd come upset looking down.
Interesting. But isn't it amazing that you could do that, Demp, for that long and not even realize it? That you just, that these habits form, and you really do need other people to see it, because you're locked in. You're trying to do your thing, and you're like, what? I look down before I pick off?
No clue. And you're right. You just form those habits, and comes from a place of comfort probably. And, you know, thankfully now that's one place where analytics and kind of R&D can really pay off. You can overlap deliveries and imaging and stuff like that, and see things that you might do before anybody else picks up on it, and have the ability to make the adjustment ahead of time. I just thought Dee Lee and I were a little bit closer than that, but
baseball.
Oh, that's such good stuff. That is so much fun. That's Dempster and Lennon JD from last night on Marquee, talking about tipping pitches and tipping pickoff stuff. Man, I will never tire of the time that baseball allows for conversations like that, as the Cubs had that one well in hand on the way to a remarkable 11-3 start that they are living through right here on 670 The Score. The Cubs are 11-3. It is the eighth time since the year 1900 that the Cubs have won at least 11 of their first 14 games in a season. In the seven times they did that beforehand, five of those times, they made the World Series, winning it three times. So look, we've talked a lot before this season, this weird little season started, that some teams were going to get going and won't really have time to regress to the mean, to come back to the pack. So why not the Cubs? There they are at 11-3. We'll talk about it with our friend Len Casper. That's next, right here on 670 The Score. It's Matt Spiegel in for Dan Bernstein for another hour. Lawrence Holmes next after me at noon.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.